طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. This morning we are featuring Boston University professor Susan Ockram, whose legal work with refugees throughout the world we have followed over the years on This Week in Palestine. We recorded a presentation by Professor Ockram at Boston University, as she focused on the plight of refugees driven out of their villages in 1948 as Israel conducted its ethnic cleansing campaign. Following Susan's presentation, you will hear Amir Toumey, who will tell the compelling story of how the refugees from his historic village of Ikrit, destroyed during the ethnic cleansing, are trying to reclaim their village. Unfortunately, the story of Ikrit is not unique. Over 350 villages were emptied and destroyed during the ethnic cleansing. And while many villagers were driven into refugee camps in Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and the West Bank, some remained or returned and are now living in Israel, or as they like to refer to it, 48. But the villagers were not allowed to return to their villages. They live in surrounding communities, but continue to identify with their village of origin. In most villages, the people are not allowed to return, even to visit the village, except for the cemetery. I vividly remember visiting the village of Sephoria outside of Nazareth with a former villager, and we had to stand in the cemetery to view the remains of the village and to hear Sephoria's story. Our host faced arrest if he took us into the former village, now a wooded hillside. Israel's cruelty knows no bounds. As a form of collective punishment, they force these villagers to live on the outskirts or in other towns and villages, rather than let them re-inhabit their village of origin, which means so much to them, and for the most part stands empty to this day. The goal is to make life difficult for Palestinians with the hope that they will leave Israel. But that is definitely not happening. Even after 67 years of exile from their beloved villages, the descendants identify with that particular piece of land. As you will hear, Ikrit's story is a bit different because it was, or is, a Christian village with a church standing at its center. And although the village was destroyed, the church remains and is allowed to function as a Christian church on a limited basis. So villagers from Ikrit, which is in 48, can go into the church as well as the cemetery. Some of the young descendants of Ikrit have decided they will occupy the church. They will actually live there, and they do. It is an amazing story that you will hear from Amir Toumey, a third-generation descendant of those driven from Ikrit in 1948. But first, Professor Susan Ockram sets the table.
What I'm going to do is try to do a very quick presentation here on the background of Ikrit, Bir Im, and really the larger question of dispossession of Palestinians, both internally displaced Palestinians and refugees. I want to give an overview of the land regime that has allowed this to happen, and then focus mostly on the Bir Im case and leave the Ikrit case for the Ikrit folks to, who are here. They, of course, know their situation better than anyone. And so I'm just going to talk about the legal issues. So I want to talk about some of the main legal mechanisms by which Palestinian refugees and displaced persons have been dispossessed of their lands and properties. And I'll give an overview of the land regime that was put in place in Israel to illustrate how the land confiscation machinery continues to dispossess Palestinians today. And I'll use the case of several villages to illustrate civil society efforts at redress. And I'll tell the story of primarily the village of Bir Im, and not the other village, two villages, Ikrit and Arba Subiyeh, but how the people of these villages have used every legal means possible to regain their lands, and then we'll hear from the activists about that continuing today. But I'm going to focus on the efforts that we made at one point to utilize the UN human rights mechanisms. And again, this is just one illustration of the enormity of the struggle by Palestinian refugees against the ongoing dispossession and land confiscation, which I think will be obvious through the story of Kafr Bir Im. So at least 750,000 refugees were displaced as a result of the wars of the conflict of 47-48, and another 400,000 due to the 1967 conflict. And over 300,000 additional Palestinians have been displaced since 1967 as a result of ongoing military occupation, armed conflict, and various international human rights and humanitarian law violations. And this gives you an idea of 1946 percentages, demographics of Palestinians and Jews. So under the 1947 UN partition plan, the Jewish state was allocated 56% of Palestine, though the Jewish population was less than a third of the population, as you saw in that prior slide, and owned no more than 6.7% of the land. As a result of the 48 conflict, the Jewish state gained control of over 78% of Palestine. And the Zionist militias and Israeli army expelled or forced out between 750,000 to 800,000 of the Palestinian population. So shortly after that, the army secured de facto control of the territory, but not de jure, that is legal control, and I'll try to explain that through the rest of the slides. The Israeli government, though, almost immediately set out to legalize Palestinian dispossession through the use of four main legal mechanisms. And I have those up there. A cluster of laws called the Emergency Regulations, the Absentee Property Law of 1950, Settlement of Title Land Registration Process, and something called the Public Purpose Ordinance. Now, these Israel's emergency regulations have been used to expel Palestinians from their property, to close off their property and surrounding areas under the claim of security reasons. And then the government declares the property abandoned or uncultivated, permitting the state to confiscate it. The emergency regulations use designations of closed areas, security zones, and cultivation of wasteland regulations to requisition Palestinian property. Now, through these measures, 1.2 million dunams of Palestinian land have been confiscated. The series of court cases brought by the Palestinian villagers of Ikrit and Bir Im to regain their lands shows that the government of Israel and the Israeli Supreme Court together have gone to great measures to thwart legal challenges to expropriations based on security concerns that are not valid. And these regulations, of course, have never been used to evacuate Jewish communities or expropriate their property. This is a comparison of land ownership and villages depopulated. This is the village of Kafr Bir Im in pre-1948 Palestine, the sister village to Ikrit. And Kafr Bir Im was a Palestinian Christian village established over 400 years ago. The homes in Kafr Bir Im were built in concentric circles around the hill, with the community church and the school in the center of the village. Prior to October 1948, there were over 1,000 people living in Kafr Bir Im. and the inhabitants hold deeds for their property today, going back to the time of the Ottomans. The land area of Kfar Biryem is 12,250 dunams, and the village church alone owns 997 dunams of the land, and actually the population and property ownership of pre-48 Kfar Biryem are not contested. This went through the series of court cases, which I'm going to talk about briefly, but these facts are not in contest. So here is a very brief explanation of the struggle of the people of the village of Kfar Biryem to regain their land. And the story started on October 29, 1948. After the hostilities had ceased, the IDF occupied the village, ordered all the villagers to assemble in the community church and surrender their weapons. And the villagers did not resist. On November 13, the IDF ordered all the residents of Kfar Biryem to move across the Lebanese border. Some obeyed, but others refused to leave and stayed in their olive orchards to wait until the IDF would allow them to return. 7 children died that winter, and the villagers tried to return home. By November 20, all of the remaining residents of the village were forced to relocate to the nearby village of Al-Jish, whose inhabitants had already become refugees by that time. Now, between 1949 and 1950, the villagers continued to try to get permission to use their agricultural land and to use the church land. In April 1951, the Israeli government leased the village land and crops to Jewish agricultural companies and hired other Palestinians to work the Kfar Biryem lands. Under the emergency regulations, the military government legalized the extra-legal actions of the Israeli military that evacuated the Palestinians from their homes. And in 1951, Israel destroyed their homes and property well after the armed conflict between Israel and the Arab states was over. Israel then confiscated the land of Kfar Biryem in 1953 and turned it over to Jewish settlements. Now, until today, large areas of the land are used by Jewish settlements for grazing a small number of cattle, and I don't know if that situation has changed. A smaller part of the land is currently used as a nature reserve at a national park maintained by the state and the JNF. And land expropriation under this scheme has had very dire consequences for the village, their descendants, and communities. They lost 12,000 dunams, or 12 square kilometers, of their land, their home, their agricultural homes, their agricultural and grazing lands, and the sole means of their livelihoods. But they also lost an entire community when they were evacuated and their village destroyed. The community of Kfar Biryem maintained an ancient history, identity, and cultural heritage as Palestinian Christians. In May of 1951, the villages of both Ikrit and Biryem filed a petition to the Israeli Supreme Court for return of their lands. And surprisingly, the Supreme Court ordered that they had the right to return as long as evacuation orders had not been issued by the military. But the military governor refused to allow the returns. So the villages submitted a second petition to the Supreme Court requesting implementation of the court's first order. And the Supreme Court asked the government of Israel why its order could not be implemented. Then on August 2nd of 1951, the military legal advisor issued a secret memo to the military to issue evacuation orders, obviously in violation of the Supreme Court decision. And in 1953, the government of Israel ordered the village land confiscated under the land acquisition law and then claimed that Biryem was abandoned land. And in September of 1953, the IDF dynamited and bombed the homes of Kfar Biryem. In 1966, the Israeli military rule ended, but the villagers were not permitted to return. And from 1966 onwards, the Biryem villagers have filed petitions to the Israeli president, the prime minister, members of parliament, and other public officials seeking return to their lands to no avail. In 2003, the Israeli Supreme Court reversed its previous decision, permitting the return of the villages, of the two villages, of Ikrit and Biryem, on the grounds that this would be a legal precedent for the millions of Palestinian refugees seeking return, and that that needed to be decided in political negotiations, not through the courts. That's the case of Svit versus Israel. So today, the former residents of Kfar Birim and their descendants number about 2,500 people. They're internally displaced in Israel and refugees in Lebanon and elsewhere. Many of the villagers and their descendants live in the homes of other abandoned property of refugees. And when the former villagers and their descendants try to go to the village to worship on various occasions, including to bury their dead, they pass a sign claiming that the site was an ancient Jewish village. We have a couple of pictures. Okay. So another important law is the 1950 Israeli Comprehensive Absentees Property Law. And under this law, any person leaving his residence for any length of time after November 29, 1947, and going to an area that was held by enemy forces or armies that fought to prevent the establishment of the State of Israel are deemed absentee, and that's a legal term, and their property is then subject to confiscation by the custodian of absentee property. Present absentees are people who were also dispossessed of their land, and they are deemed to have left even though they have remained on the property throughout the conflict. And this designation was a fiction to evict Palestinians, and the absentee property legislation has resulted in another 4 to 5 million dunams of Palestinian land being confiscated within Israel and transferred to the Israeli Development Authority. So I'm not going to say much about land holdings, how they were held, except to say that because of the legal nature of Palestinian land holdings under Ottoman time, most Palestinian Arabs had not registered individual title to their lands before 1948, so only about one-third of Palestine had been registered by the British during the Mandate period. Now, in the case of this is Bedouin land of the village of Shibli. I'm not going to say much more, except that the Bedouins, because they had communal land holdings, have been particularly vulnerable to dispossession. They don't have individual title. And this is another case, the Arabasubiye village, Bedouin village. I won't say much more about it. But they went from owning and using over 18,000 dunams of land to today, where their land is actually completely confiscated. Okay. So the next land scheme I just want to briefly talk about is the Public Purpose Ordinance. And this allows Israel to take lands for certain public purposes. Two legal cases have interpreted the reach of this ordinance in such a way that Palestinians cannot effectively challenge any use of the ordinance to take their lands. In a case called Dweik, the court said that the government of Israel doesn't have to give any reason for confiscating land for public purposes, as long as the Minister of Finance certifies that the land is needed for a public purpose. That's all that's required. And in another case called Dor, the court said that if the government decides to change the purpose of the land taken under this ordinance so that it benefits Jews only, that's a permissible taking. And between 48 and 92, this particular ordinance was used to confiscate another 1.8 million dunams of private Palestinian land. So I think this chart really shows well the change in land ownership. Following the 48 war, Israel was in control of 20,600 square kilometers of land, but the state and private Jewish owners had legal title to no more than 2,900 square kilometers. The State of Israel, through the means of the land regime that I've been describing, expropriated and confiscated some 17,000 square kilometers of land, mostly owned by Palestinians. And by 2001, Israel had confiscated almost 89% of the land owned by Palestinians in Israeli territory. So what this chart shows you is that from 1948, when 94% of Palestine was owned or held by Palestinians, while 6% was owned by Jews, until today there's been an almost complete reversal. The land mechanisms have resulted in 93% of the land area of Israel now held or owned ostensibly by the JNF and the State of Israel, and no lands held by these entities can ever be transferred to non-Jews. And I thank my colleague and friend Osama Halabi for this slide. Meanwhile, another story in the occupied territories where the legal mechanisms are not exactly the same, but they operate in a very similar manner. 400,000 Palestinians were expelled or displaced by the 67 war, and approximately 20,000 have been displaced every year since 1967. And most of this land confiscation has taken place through a series of military orders issued by Israel's military civil administration, as it calls itself. And many of the NGOs call it the quiet transfer of Palestinians that has resulted in land confiscation taking place through revocation of residency permits, denial of family unification, demolition of homes, deportations and removals, and most recently, the construction of the separation wall. I'm not going to say more about the military orders. You can see the results here and the abandoned property orders. And I just want to come to you by 67, two-thirds of the land in the West Bank had not been officially registered. So this military order 291 froze the land registration process that had been ongoing under Jordanian rule until that time. And now one-third of the West Bank, over one-third, is now claimed by Israel as state domain. And in 2004, Haaretz published what were previously non-public figures indicating that another 13% of the West Bank was to be designated as state domain land and confiscated from private Palestinian owners. So I want to mention just a couple of things about post-67 events. The Ministerial Committee for Development of the Negev and the Galilee allocated $2 billion for breaking up, and the purpose was breaking up densely populated Palestinian areas. And in 2005, the Shimon Peres plan was a package of benefits for Jews who agreed to move to the Galilee. And many of you have heard about the Gaza disengagement as though it was a movement out of occupation, but part of the plan was relocation of the settlers to the West Bank, but also to Galilee and the Negev, and a compensation bill that was passed by the Knesset, which authorized a bonus of $50,000 to $80,000 for Gaza settlers to settle in the Galilee or the Negev. So very quickly about the wall. Here you can see the route of the wall and the percentage of Palestinian West Bank population affected. I'll just mention some of the major effects. It makes permanent the land confiscation in the West Bank of the last 45 years and brings in major settlement blocks. Palestinians holding Jerusalem IDs are stripped of their right to live in Jerusalem. It restricts the right to work, to education, to health care, and family unity. And it's caused the destruction of homes and property that are going on even as we speak. So with this background, it should be obvious that durable solutions for Palestinians dispossessed of their lands and properties and made refugees must include their rights to return property restitution and compensation. But we're no closer to durable solutions today than I think we were in 1948. And the efforts to redress their rights in the Israeli court system have been essentially futile for Palestinians, as you see from the example we're going to hear from about the Ikrit case. Hundreds of Palestinian land expropriation cases have been appealed to the Israeli Supreme Court, and none has been successful. Israel is a party to all the major human rights instruments and international humanitarian law treaties, but it has not ratified any of the international complaint mechanisms that allow remedies through those treaties. The U.S. has, of course, been Israel's protector at the UN and used its veto consistently to block effective action at the Security Council. In addition, there is what we call the protection gap, which is critical treaty provisions and international agency statutes that omit Palestinians from basic rights guarantees or have been interpreted in such a way to do that. The Kfar Bir'im and the Shibli and Araba Subiya families have all sought intervention through the international machinery. After all their remedies were exhausted in Israel, the villagers filed a petition in the UN Human Rights Commission in 2005 for return and restitution of their land. And the petition met all the requirements, was accepted by the Commission Subcommittee on Communications, and then inexplicably was unfiled without explanation. And that is it's unprecedented. We have never heard of it, those of us who've been working in the UN for ages, never heard of such a thing as an unfiling after a filing was accepted. But the petitioners refiled what's called the 1503 petition in 2006, and it was again accepted for review by the new UN Human Rights Council. And then in 2008, the petitioners were told that the Human Rights Council would no longer consider the petition. Again, no explanation was offered. So the villagers of Bir'im, Ikrit, and Shibli have been assisted over all these years by enormous efforts of lawyers, non-governmental organizations, activists, and a very determined coalition of civil society actors. And I think what these efforts have shown us is that despite the very strong legal rights even recognized by the Israeli Supreme Court itself, that these rights of restitution, property restitution, return and compensation, that Palestinians have been unable to access the remedies available to victims of egregious and ongoing human rights violations. So far, painstaking and strategic efforts to use both the Israeli domestic and the global UN mechanisms have been futile in these cases. And the case study, I think, tells us that legal efforts alone will be insufficient to redress Palestinian rights, and that new and strategic ways of using the law, along with grassroots and other activism, must be found. And so with that note, I turn it over to the activists.
First of all, I want to thank Dr. Suzanne Akram for her extraordinary presentation. It was amazing. Thank you. Thank you, Shadia, for presenting the case, and of course, Michelle, for organizing this event. First of all, hello. My name is Amir Tomi. I'm from the third generation of the descendants of the village of Ikrit. My grandfather and grandmother were from Ikrit. They were born there until they were exiled in 1948. I wanted to tell you about the things we are doing for the past 3 years in Ikrit, and that we have been presenting to people from the start of our project 3 years ago until now, right here in Boston. So I'm very honored, me, Shadia, and Ella are very honored to be here and to join you in this event, tell you our story. Michelle has told you, I'm a student at the University of Haifa. This is my final year. I'm studying political science. And I wanted to tell you my experience about living in the Church of Ikrit. I started my journey with the youth group of Ikrit 3 years ago, as you have seen in the movie. After the end of the summer camp in 2012, we decided that we wanted to return to the village in order to live there, to experience life in Ikrit before we die and we get buried there in the cemetery. And that's actually what we did. We got together, me and 10 of the guys and the girls from the summer camp, and we decided to just be there. Our main goal was not to leave the village and just to live there under church until something happens. We decided to go on with the struggle from the church, from up there. But of course it wasn't easy. The thing was that we had to get used to the conditions up there, because the village, the hill itself, the church itself is isolated. The closest place we can get food from or we can go to buy some other stuff is an hour away. So we had and we still have a lot of difficulties. The second thing, as you saw, was that the land administration officers always come to the church, to where we live. They always come to take our properties. Their goal is to stop the struggle of the people of Ikrit, and specifically to stop the struggle of the youth of our group up there. So everything that is outside the church and not inside the building of the church, they come and take for us. They took a lot of times, they came, they took our beds, they took our couches, our chairs, everything they see outside, they take it. Even the wood that we use for heating in the winter, because we have difficult winters up there, as you saw the picture of the snow and everything. So as you can see, we are having a lot of difficulties up there, but you can say that we got used to it, because we feel that Ikrit is our home. Even though I was born and raised in Haifa, but I feel that Ikrit is my home, and it is the place for me to start my struggle. The struggle starts in Ikrit, as we believe, and it ends there. So the first thing was just to sit in the church, manage our struggle, and to return, inshallah, at the end. And from our experience in the youth conferences where we were educated and where we were raised since we were young, we wanted to get the experience of living in Ikrit into the younger generations. As you know, we grew up in these summer camps, and now we are the ones who teach the struggle of Ikrit, the history of Ikrit, and we try to imagine the return with the small children who come with us. So we have a group of children from the third and fourth generation who we educate, and we try to just get them up to the church so they can see the land that they were destined to be away from, but they were supposed to be living on. So that is one of our goals too. We want to educate people about Ikrit, especially the young. And we also want to get the people of the village back to the village itself. We hold festivals in the church. We hold, we celebrate our holy days up there. We have monthly masses. The thing is that we want the people of the village to rebuild their faith in the case, rebuild their faith in return. So if they come, that was our theory, if they come to Ikrit, they hold their weddings up there. They see as their children grow in the youth conferences, so they can get connected to the land at the end and return with full faith at the end. So, sorry, I'm just a little bit here. So, because we are a youth group and we want to do things in our own way, since the last ruling of the court in 51, we decided that we're going to take it to the next level. We're going to go to Ikrit, we're going to plant trees, we're going to get some stuff up there. But the problem is that everything we do, they come and take it. Or if we plant trees, which is the simplest thing that connects us to the land, they come and they uproot it. So we want people to know about that, and we want the people of the village and the Arabs and the Israelis and the Israeli government to know that we will not give up. We will stay at the village and we will manage the struggle from up there, because this is the place we want to return to. We felt as a youth group that we do not have time and we do not want to wait another 67 years to go back to the village to return. So we decided that we're just going to go up there and see what happened. And I hope at the end of it something will happen, because it has been happening for the last 3 years. We see an increasing number of people coming to the village, even if they are not from the village. And we want more people to come and support us, just like you. So that is what has been going on in Ikrit for the last 3 years. We go to work and to university from Ikrit. We are nearly all students up there. I actually studied for my SATs up there, and now I'm finishing my degree while staying in that church. So that's what I want to tell you, that when you are in that church, you just feel that you feel the success. You feel that this is the place where you can grow up from and develop at the end, and maybe even help other people. And that's actually what happened. Our youth project was developed in other villages. Dr. Akram talked about the village of Kufr Biram. Actually, it is considered a sister village of Ikrit. And a year after we declared our return to the village, the youth of Kufr Biram declared theirs. So we have been having joint meetings with them. We have been talking with them about the youth conferences and how can we work together. And now after we return to Palestine, I will talk to the instructor of the youth up there, and we will have joint meetings also. Another example of our influence in other villages was that there is a village near Tarshiha called Suhmata, if somebody knows it. And a year after we decided to return, we helped them organize their first summer camp, which was really successful. That was their first time sleeping in the village, staying in the village after 48. So I think this movement is really growing with our help and with your help. And I think we could get to something at the end. So the most important thing is, as I said, was to stay in the village, educate people about the village, and let our movement grow at the end. And at this point comes your part. If you think that you support Ikrit's case and the other Palestinian villages as uprooted villages, we want you to support us. There are forms on that table that we want you, of course, if you like, we want you to fill, because we are trying to organize a circle which is called Friends of Ikrit, and we will be sharing with people like you the news of the struggle and what we are doing. And of course, I will show you our Facebook page. We've been having it for the 3 years since we returned. We post news up there about our staying in the village, about the officers coming and expelling our stuff and everything. So if you would like to follow us and help us with our struggle, we would like you to fill those forms so we could be, so we could stay in touch at the end. So this is our struggle. This is the way we are doing it. We're trying new ways by social media. We came here to talk to you guys. And if anybody has any questions about and also for Shadia, about our struggle, about what we are doing up there, I would be happy to answer right now.
I have a question for you. Yeah. So, can you talk a little bit about what your day is like up there in the church? I mean, you know, I mean, we probably think of a church as you come in, you switch the lights on, and you have a water fountain. So can you talk about what it's like inside the church when you're living
there?
Yeah,
the sushi bar.
Well, actually, the church is really small. It's not a big church. Mm-hmm. And we are 10 guys and girls living there, so there's not a lot of space for everybody. But actually, you can say that we got used to it. Despite the difficulties and everything, I have my own desk in which I study for my exams and everything. And you can say that we work in shifts. So if I need to go to work or to university, somebody else comes and replaces me at the church. So there's always somebody there, just in case something happens.
Yeah. And do you have electricity?
Actually, we have a solar system of electricity because the state hasn't given us permission to have electricity up there. Even though last year we had a court ruling, we won the court, and electricity should come real soon, but we are facing a lot of bureaucracy and difficulties. And I personally think they're doing it on purpose, just so we wouldn't get the electricity at the end. But even though at the end, as our project started, and I said that we didn't need the state, and we don't need a decision from the state to go back to return, so we just return. We are creating our own electricity. We don't need the state. Yeah.
What about water?
We have a water line
from
the cemetery. Yeah. Because the cemetery is still active, so the state acknowledges it, and so we have water there. So we got the water from the cemetery down the hill to the church up there, and it was also a hard project. Yeah. All right. If anybody has some questions also for Shadi about the yeah. All right. Yeah.
So what's the hardest part for you in living in the church, either like a physical, like, you know, living in the church or otherwise?
Actually, we always fear for, because we are university students and people who work in factories and stuff, we are always afraid of arrests. So as you have seen in the movie, three of us got arrested last year. So if the officers always come and try to take our properties, at the end they will arrest us because we are still putting properties up there. So even despite our fears, we are just going on with the project because this is the project of our life. I think this is more important than anything that happens to me. Because if you want to live and be happy in life, you got to be in your place, which for us is different.
That layout in
your... Actually, the existence of the church is the thing that I think kept the community together since they demolished the village. The church plays a big role in that because people come to the monthly masses we hold. We have a priest up there who comes every month and all the holidays. We celebrate the holidays up there. So some people of the village see Ikrit as the church first, and then as a community and as a village. So the church is also the center for our struggle since 48. So, and we don't see it only as a church; we see it as a home for everybody, and not just for these 10 guys living up there. And yeah, sorry. No, it's okay.
Are your parents?
My parents?
Your parents and the parents of the other people in the church.
I think our parents are proud of us at some point because we are the ones...
On the point.
Because we are the ones who are going on with the struggle. We started this, and this started a big movement, which is going on and on. So even despite the fears... And the fear that we may get arrested or our future will be ruined because we are arrested, they support us at every aspect.
That was Amer Toumey telling a story of the attempts to occupy his historic Palestinian village of Ikrit in what is now Israel. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.